It is a pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in Rochester, New York. Keith Smith brings more than two decades of valuation experience to the management of the Bonhoeffer Fund. Keith was previously a managing director of a valuation firm. His expertise includes corporate transactions, distressed loans, derivatives, and intangible assets. Buffett and Graham's value-oriented approach of pursuing the 50 cents on the dollar opportunities underpins Keith's investment strategy. The combination of his experience and track record led Keith to commit most of his investable net worth to the Bonhoeffer Fund model. Keith is a CFA charter holder and received his MBA from UCLA. I want to also draw your attention to Keith's past sharing of insights and ideas with our community, all of which I've enjoyed tremendously and found to be of great value. So Keith, on behalf of the MOI Global membership community, a very warm welcome to you. Please go ahead.
Thanks, John. This is this conference has always been a highlight of my year, just being able to look at folks' ideas and some of the interesting ideas that many of the folks have, and appreciate being invited back. So this year, the focus is I'm going to be focusing on what I term as fundamental alternative investments. And I've got three ideas that will sort of illustrate what that really means. First of all, I've got the disclaimer here. This particular presentation, there's no advice or recommendations. I or the fund may hold some of the securities mentioned here, or we may sell at any time. And everyone should do their own due diligence in regards to specific securities and examples that I'm going to be describing here. So in terms of alternative investments, this is a topic that's getting a lot of air recently, given sort of the high relative valuations of both stocks and bonds in the investing world. And so one way to sort of look at alternative investments is to break them into two sort of segments. There's ones that are described as more as fundamental investments. These are basically investments that are driven by non-correlated set of cash flows. Examples could be like bonds, royalties, reinsurance, and renting and leasing assets. Another set is more of synthetic, which are basically mixing existing asset classes in different ways. Factors are an example of what those are. It's more of the non-bait market type factors like value and growth, et cetera, and momentum. Some of the downsides of the synthetic ones is that they can change over time because they're based upon correlations of assets holding. The fundamental ones are really based more upon cash flows, and so you're really dealing more with an arbitrage situation of the fundamentals versus the synthetics. And so in this particular presentation, we're going to be focusing on equities that have bond-like characteristics. And so we're going to have three of those examples that we're going to be discussing today. So in terms of these bond-like equity securities, there's really two sort of groupings that happen here. First of all, it's either the security structure or the revenue model is basically going to allow the holder of the security to get a first lien claim on a cash flow stream. And given that, there's really two types of securities that have these types of characteristics. The first ones are what I describe as sort of credit type securities. This is where the structure of the security itself gives you the first claim on the assets. And examples could be triple net lease real estate, business development companies that have good underwriting. In both these cases, across all of these, one of the key things is basically having a good underwriting approach that basically can be replicated across the opportunity set that exists. And then another one of these types of opportunities is leasing. So basically in leasing, the revenue model provides the first claim on the assets because in essence, these assets are being used by folks to generate revenue. So these can include things like aircraft, ships, construction and industrial equipment, and then autos. Some interesting aspects of this kind of a business. If the business is more of a local business, you can get some interesting consolidation opportunities and economies of scale through clumping in certain geographies or clustering in certain geographies, It also, you also can get synergies associated with purchasing. So in essence, what these models are doing is they're cost-effective sharing of assets across a number of different users. The difference between these and the credit situations, though, however, is that they can be more risky because they have shorter duration, you know, leasing agreements. However, these can be offset by diversification across geographies and customer types and different types of equipment that's being leased. One of the key things in the three examples we're going to be talking about today is that in both the leasing and in the credit situations, the companies that we're looking at basically are going to do something unique or a little bit different than your typical typical situation. So in these kind of situations, what I'm going to be presenting next are sort of like a framework of analysis that can be used to determine whether, you know, whether these are good securities and what kind of rates of return can be expected that we can get from these securities. So for example, in the bond-like securities, credit analysis is very important. In both, and in the two cases we're going to look at, these are companies that have basically have an underwriting process. And so what you're going to want to do in each one of these types of companies cases is to basically have almost like a look through coverage ratio to get an idea of what is the coverage of the portfolio. And it's very important also to take a look at the past track record of the teams that are associated with these. And then where did the team come from? In some of the cases, if the team came from more of a commercial banking background or a background that's more based on where the focus is trying to maximize return with a given amount of loss, that's the kind of situation that I think is more favorable versus the other situation, which is basically trying to minimize loss with a return sort of structure. And then the way that we look at these things is we do a relative yield analysis, and really it's a combination of expected yield from the current situation plus growth and dividends over time. You could estimate the growth by basically taking a look at the components in each one of these things that do growth. So for example, in real estate, you can look at contractual increases in rents is one of the factors. And as we go through these examples, you'll see how we sort of deconstruct what the growth parameters are here. And if you have a large enough sample of these types of underlying properties, underlying leases, you can get a good idea of how to really come up with models for these parameters and get an idea of, so you can get some confidence that they're going to stay the same going forward. And then for the final aspect is you can compare the total returns with similar bonds or equities in the value chain to see where you can get the best return on risk. If the particular security is giving you, if you can find another security that gives you a better return than the ones you're examining, then clearly you want to go with the former rather than the latter. And then in some industries, the credit/leasing is the best place to invest, especially in some cyclical businesses, because the leasing provide a little bit more of a recurring revenue, and especially is we'll talk about in one situation here, with the pricing being relatively low, you get a really good risk reward trade-off on this. So one of the things that we do in terms of this analysis is take a look at benchmarking. What are some of the key parameters we can look at? So one of the key things in all these kind of situations is you want to determine where in the customer's capital structure does the claim lie? Where is it in the customer's capital structure? And then how important are the assets to the business? In some cases, what you're really trying to look for are assets that are mission critical. So if you're dealing with a triple net lease company, you're looking for companies for the real estate that has really good locations. So in essence, that becomes mission critical to the customer. If you're talking about leasing some equipment to a construction company, again, the construction equipment becomes mission critical. And so that's where you get the importance of the assets. And in both those cases, the structural location is senior. So in essence, that would match the kind of situation we're looking for. And the second part of it is doing credit analysis of the customers. Some of these companies have done a really good job of providing this look through information so you can get an idea of sort of what's really going on. So what you really ideally would like to get is sort of a weighted average credit rating or coverage ratio to get an idea of sort of what's going on in the portfolio. And some ways to sort of sort of create some additional risk mitigation here is through customer, geographic, and industry diversification, along with longer duration. And if there is rent escalations in leasing contracts, that helps out a lot because, in essence, you have built-in growth that's going to happen there. And then the final aspect is how much is the underlying credit provider leverage? So these would be the companies that are actually, you know, providing the leverage to the business. You want them to be more modestly levered. The higher leverage are, of course, then you're basically adding leverage on top of leverage, which can lead to some issues. And we'll see that in some of the examples we're going to go through here. And so the key piece of this, the bottom line here, is trying to estimate what is the total return you're going to get from these types of companies or these cash flows, which is basically the current yield and then growth. And the growth basically comes from three areas in these types of businesses. First of all, you can get increases in the cash flow from either rent or lease payment increases, which can happen over time. You can reinvest the cash flows to basically get improvements and keep the business going. And you can also get growth through a geographic and product expansion, increased utilization, et cetera, for example, in the leasing types companies. What the key thing here is the payout ratio is going to determine what the internal growth is. And so from a comparison perspective, if you can find one of these types of situations where it offers you not only a current yield or total return that's greater than, let's say, some of the customer's bond yields, and in addition, you're getting growth, that's a win-win, and that's the kind of situations that you're trying to look for here. And then if you're dealing with, let's say, some of the smaller customers, both diversification and cash collection up front, for example, in the leasing case, can really provide some additional risk mitigation there. So our first company we're going to be looking at is a company called Store Capital. Store Capital is a triple net lease REIT. What triple net lease means is, in essence, that the customer is basically renting the property from the property owner, so Store becomes the property owner. And then what happens is that the property, the leaser basically pays for all upgrades. And so what Store in essence is doing is it's providing financing and collecting a check in the mail. And so there's not a whole lot of, in most cases, not a whole lot of additional work that Store has to do beyond just initially structuring the initial lease and then providing the capital for the company. So in essence, they're a capital provider. At this point, Store has about 400 customers across 2,200 locations in 49 states. Management has done a pretty good job. They've basically done this two times before and sold the leasing firms, one called FFCA and the second one's called Sprint, to other investors in the end. And then the nice thing, one of the key things about a lot of these types of companies opening is you want to get a large proprietary data flow. So in essence, these are direct relationships these companies are making with end leasers of these businesses. And then finally, management has really, in this case, has really good incentives. They have such things as, you know, they have stock ownership guidelines for each one of their executives ranging from 3 to 6 times salary. They do issue some restricted stock units. The dilution of that is relatively modest. It's only 0.5% per year. And then at this point, the executives own about 1% of the business, but it's a relatively large business. Then the other thing about Store is that it has a very large runway. At this point, it's one of the larger triple net lease firms in the marketplace. There's probably a half dozen of them that are probably their size or greater. But this company only has 2%. So on a combined basis, you're only talking about 10% market share. So this company does have a long runway. And then one of the key things, again, sort of the benchmarks we had mentioned before that I like to look at in these types of businesses is what's happened over the past 5 years, since these guys have a repeatable process, what's happened over the past 5 years and I think this is a starting point for what the expectation could be going forward. Over the past 5 years, book value and dividend growth has gone up by around 13% per year, and AFFO per share growth has gone up by roughly 7% per year. So the key thing, just to give some background on the industry itself, is again, this, you're leasing property to customers for mission critical functions. In most cases, you're dealing with storefronts if you're dealing with retail type businesses or services, and manufacturing. The nice thing about these leases is they typically are 10 years or longer. Again, all the facility expenses are paid by the leaser. They have rent increases with them, which basically is sort of like a bond with a bump in it. So in essence, what you're doing when you're buying this particular business store is you're buying property plus a package of leases, which are basically like first lien loans against all the businesses that they lease these properties to. One of the unique differentiators of store versus some of the other players in the marketplace is they actually segment the, let's say you got a customer that owns a dozen stores. Store will focus on the stores that have high cash flow associated with sort of a subgroup, and those are the ones that they'll end up leasing. So they've tried to find the properties that have the best cash flow unit economic spaces, basically. Just overall, I mean, interesting about the triple net lease firms is companies like Store, that I'm called Realty Income, and I'm called Broadstone Net Lease. These companies have outperformed the REIT index by a significant amount over the past 10 years, despite having these long-term leases and lower current multiples and historical multiples. So, I mean, what I find interesting about this market is if you look at the other companies that are non-triple net lease, they seem to have higher FFO multiples for whatever reason. But this is still happening today. And again, sort of the key piece here is the underwriting is a key differentiator. One of the key things here that Store and the other guys that are successful in this business have really done well is you're basically underwriting the business, because what's going to have more value here is the lease versus the property. And you're going to focus on growing businesses with moats. And the other piece is the real estate piece, which you'll also value. The key piece there is that if the leaser defaults, you want to find out if there's any alternative use for the real estate. But what's really driving the value here is sort of the first lien loans or the leases you have with all your customers. And why this business exists is this becomes a very cost-effective way for you to basically sell your real estate if you're not in the real estate business to someone else. And so you can focus on your core business. And if you're doing well there, then the guys like Store and other these guys will basically buy the real estate and take a lower rate of return than in theory you could get on your own business. So we talked a little bit about sort of the management expertise there. Again, this team's been around for Store specifically, has been around since 1994. There's some additional information here on their returns, how they've performed versus other REITs. Another interesting thing about Store is Berkshire has actually invested roughly they're up to 9.8%, I think is, and they basically, that's close to the maximum that someone's allowed to invest in a REIT. And they did an investment in 2007 at a marketability adjusted AFFO multiple of around 13.6. Right now it's selling at 15. So you're buying at a slight premium to what Berkshire bought in a few years ago. And so, I mean, I think just the Berkshire and the way that they themselves provides a little bit of credence to the underwriting process and the way this whole team has worked out. I encourage folks, if you're interested in this, to actually go on their site. They do a pretty good job of laying out exactly what they do. They have a series of videos that describe their whole process. So it's really an interesting read from that perspective. And some of the things we're talking about here in terms of the underwriting, they actually have an internally generated model where they estimate what the credit rating of the leases. So you may actually be able to get some lease enhancements based upon the specific property characteristics within the leases, in addition to what the tenant credit would be. The average purchase price of these things has been roughly around 82% of replacement value. The average interest coverage ratio is about 2.1. The top 10 customers only represent 12% of the portfolio. The interesting thing about this thing is, yes, you have long lease durations of roughly 14 years. And you have price escalators in this case. And that the other interesting or neat thing about these companies is they get financial statements of each one of their properties mostly on a quarterly basis. And this allows them to see issues, profitability issues beforehand, and either deal with it by either selling the property. And that's sort of like what they do, or figuring out a way to sort of increase the profitability of the particular property itself. So if we look at, we do a sort of total returns analysis like we initially described there. We start out with total return equals yield plus growth. So the current yield is roughly 4.4%. They roughly pay out about 70% of their cash flow. The growth is roughly 5% organic. Historically, it's been about 7.2%. So they do have increased rents of about 1.8% per year, and that's going to lead to roughly around a 3% AFFO growth. And the reason for that is the company has leverage itself. And so what you're actually doing is you're actually, you know, for every percentage increase in rent, the AFFO growth is going to go up by, it looks like, roughly 50% more. And that's roughly about what the debt to equity ratio is. And then you've got the reinvested cash flow, which is a 30% retention rate that generates around roughly 3% AFFO growth. And then the residual is basically other things the company does. So that we mentioned before, if a client looks like they're running into an issue, they may try to dispose of a property. Those good disposals offset by credit issues that they do have. And they also have made accretive acquisitions over time. And so when you add all those additional factors together, it's actually adding about 2% AFFO growth over time. So if we take a look at the what's called the lease portfolio, what I call lease portfolio analysis, one way to look at this business is sort of a spread business between what's called the gross cap rate, which is the cap rate is the amount of cash flow divided by the property value, plus escalators divided by the cost of debt. And in this case, it's roughly 4.9% for STORE. They do have an investment grade credit rating, so their current interest rate's around 4.5%. Again, we talk modest debt of roughly 50% debt to equity. And then there's an incremental cost return on equity of roughly around 11%. In the next slide, we're going to just compare the company to some of the other sort of other comps that are out there in the marketplace. So, you know, if you look at some of the key parameters here, you've got lease escalators, the payout ratio, that cap spread less debt gives you an idea of sort of what in essence, the net interest margin of the business is, the average lease term. But as you can see from here, STORE and another company called Broadstone basically have relatively low AFFO multiples, decent dividend yields, but then also they have the highest lease escalations and the largest cap spread less debt, which in essence is equivalent to sort of like a net interest margin. So if we look at currently at STORE, the valuation's at roughly a 15.1 AFFO multiple, which is a 6.6% AFFO yield. One way to look at these types of situations is to use sort of the Graham formula, which is he's got that 8.5 plus 2G. If we look at those formulas right now, just from organic growth, we get roughly around 19% as being a fair multiple. And for using 7.2% growth, we get about 22.5%. So we've got a 4.4% dividend yield, and you're buying a first lien portfolio, 75% investment grade, 25% high yield with growing coupons. The other thing is, the nice thing about these businesses is that this is more of a, you know, it doesn't jump out as super cheap, but in essence, it's a high quality asset. I mean, I think with Berkshire being involved, this sort of leads credence to that. And the key piece behind a lot of these is basically the underwriting process. These guys have developed a really good underwriting process that's repeatable and could continue to grow. So they have a huge potential to continue to reinvest the capital that they've actually, you know, generated over time to continue to grow the business. And there's one other quality underwriter I want to note in the space that's called Broadstone Net Lease. They're primarily a privately offered company, but they do have SEC reporting, so you can get the information from the SEC site. They yield roughly around 6%, have about 4.4% organic growth from rent increases. They're trading at roughly around the same amount. And that management team, again, has sort of commercial banking and real estate operations experience. So in essence, that's STORE Capital, which is the first of the group of the companies that I wanted to discuss that sort of have this bond-like with equity securities types of characteristics. So the next one is actually a company that's a business development company. And basically, it's a company called TPG Specialty Lending. And what I think is special about this particular business right now, just get from an overview, they have 49 loans across 17 industries. But in my opinion, the real key aspect of this is the core team that's running this business basically has been doing commercial underwriting for a bank since the 1990s. When I was in my previous job, I worked with them in the probably early 2000s. And got to see some of their underwriting, which was very high quality. And so, in essence, you've got a team here who basically is a commercial bank level underwriting versus a lot of other players in the space that really have much more of a high yield sort of approach or underwriting level. And in my opinion, that's what leads to the results, which you'll see these guys have very few defaults in terms of the way they do it. They also have a very large deal flow. So 99% of their deals come from their own deal flow, and they're also tied to TPG Capital. The particular group has the first right of any TPG credit product that's basically originated in the United States. And so they do have basically a preferential position from that perspective. What these guys do is they, again, going back to the theme of doing something a little bit different, these guys basically will they focus on loans. They basically give loans that are associated with intangible assets, for example, software recurring revenues, or or biotech sort of licensing royalties. And so that's a little bit different than your typical sort of cash flow based lender. They also do some stuff with distress loans, providing inventory based, asset based lending type stuff to. For example, they provided something to Sears, and that turned out to be a very good situation recently, where basically they were the first lien on a Sears loan based upon the inventory. And then once Sears went into bankruptcy, they converted that into a first return of capital DIP loan. And so as Sears sells assets, they should be getting their money back. What they try to focus on in terms of loan size is they basically try to focus on right below the syndication level, which reduces some of the competition in the business. So they are clearly focusing on areas where they can add some value there. Again, this is one of the few BDCs that have actually grown over time. And I think that's a testament to these guys, to this team's underwriting approach versus a lot of other people that are in the space. So you have book value plus dividend growth of roughly 10% per year with these guys over the 5 years. Their average return on equity has been roughly 11.7%. Just to provide an overview of sort of the BDC marketplace, basically what BDCs do is they basically provide debt financing to middle market firms. So they're basically providing bank they're provide they're acting as banks to firms that don't fit the bank's risk profile. And with Dodd-Frank, that has increased as you can imagine, increased the target market that these guys have. In my opinion, the key piece here is underwriting is more important than growth, because the key thing is you want to make sure you don't lose money. And therefore, the way that I've looked at these things is similar to banks. Which is basically focusing on underwriting and costs. And I think what's happened in a lot in the space is that most of these BDCs, on average, have high-risk loans. On average, they've generated about roughly 5.6 return on equity, which in combinations they have high distributions, which has led to high book value. And that leads to most of these companies selling at discounts to book as a result of the poor underwriting. The poor underwriting process leading to these losses, and then it takes a while for them to basically work themselves out of these loans. So these guys are sort of in perpetual discount to book value, and it becomes more, in my opinion, it becomes much more difficult to evaluate these things because, the quite it versus like a situation like, for example, with TPG. They're a lot easier to evaluate because they basically have a good underwriting process, and the good underwriting process, in essence, sort of reduces a lot of sort of the uncertainty associated with bad loans. So the key thing in this thing is just as in the case of STORE, underwriting is the key differentiator. So in essence, what TPG does is they underwrite the customer's business, and they focus again on growing firms with moat. So their largest sectors of companies they loan money to are companies like software companies and business services businesses that are growing, very similar to the types of businesses that STORE is basically buying the real estate associated with it. And the key piece here too is that they have a very proprietary source deals. So anything that TPG works on that they originate, they've got first dibs in the US, and then plus their other contacts that they've made over the years with other private equity firms to provide some of these this underwriting. So again, the focus here, as in the case of STORE, is just the management team's expertise. The management team, again, has had experience in specialty lending since the 1990s. Actually, the company was bought by Rich Kovacek of Norwest / Wells Fargo in the 1990s. So, I mean, I think that's just another sort of indication of sort of the quality that, that is associated with sort of this team. It's very value-seeking. They've done a few sort of activist investments, one in Tick and another one in Triangle. And that's sort of a, you know, they're willing to do things that are outside the box, but they have a good underwriting discipline, which I think is what you're really looking for in these kind of cases. And so these, when I was working with them at Wells, they did a great job in terms of the losses were very, very low. And they've done a great job since IPOing with TPG. Basically, they've generated around a 13% year return on a per share basis, 10% on a book value basis, compared to the other sort of comparisons we can look here are sort of high yield funds, because in essence, these guys are selling high yield. High yields generate roughly around 3.2% per year. If you look at BDC indexes, it's 2.4%. And that 2.4%, again, sort of is reflecting some of the previous industry stuff I had mentioned before, the fact that a good number of the BDCs have really poor underwriting and constantly sell at this discount to book, and that's what's led to the poor performance. These guys are the exception to that. In terms of sort of the underwriting piece of this, again, they have very high, 94% is first lien, very low loan losses, about 50 basis points per year since 2013. The way that these loans are typically ranked by these BDCs is they have a ranking system of 1, 2, 3, 4, sometimes 5. If you're 3 or higher, typically those loans have some issue or potential issues with them. So in this case, TPG has the lowest percentage of any BDC. They're roughly around 3% are ranked 3 or higher. They've had no non-accruals since 2012. The top 10 of their customers is 35%. The maturity is around 4.1 years. The loan maturity is around 4.1 years. Now, the one caveat about this is a lot of these BDCs have relatively high fees. TPG has what I would say is more of middle of the road fees. 34% of net interest income is probably the way I look at it is basically take a look at the net interest income. How much are they really taking out of that? But for that fee, they've still been able to generate ROEs of 12%. So I mean, these guys are doing a great job. They're taking their fee, but in essence, I still think on an overall basis for an investor, the fee is worth the amount, definitely in comparison to the other sort of similar risk type of BDCs and or high yield type of investments that would be not correlated with the stock market. So if we go back to our analytical framework of looking at total return, in this case, you've got roughly an 9.8% current yield. You've got an 85% payout ratio. So in essence, they're retaining roughly around 15%. And that's going to give you roughly around a 1.8% book value per year. Book value growth, they have credit losses of around 50 basis points. So that gives you the net NAV growth of around 1.2. So you're talking about an expected return here of probably like around 11%. Their net interest margin, including fees, is roughly 10.7%, which is great compared to most other financial institutions, and 7% without fees. I mean, these are just huge spreads. And the key piece behind it is what kind of losses do you get associated with this? You combine this with the 50 basis point losses, and you just end up with some really nice nice economics here. Again, sort of the 50 basis point credit losses. Currently, these guys do have leverage, so they've got a debt of roughly 0.83, their investment grade, so they're basically at 4.3% in terms of their current interest rate. Now, here's sort of TPG compared to some of the other major BDCs that are out there. These are the high-quality ones. I've sort of have excluded the ones that I would say are more lower quality, and when I'm looking at quality, I'm looking at sort of the benchmarks that are at sort of in the bottom of the chart here. So these cases, you've got companies that have, you know, less than or greater than three, the percentage of the loans are less than, or that are, yeah, that are less than or greater than or equal to 3%, which is sort of the problem loans. Now, Main Street doesn't report that, so that's why TPG is the lowest of the ones that are here. Another way to take a look at the portfolio is what portion of the portfolio is first lien senior secured. Again, TPG is basically by far better than most of the other companies that are out there, and again, they have the highest ROE. The expenses, like saying, is one of the downsides compared to, like, say somebody like a Main Street. However, you know, it's in line with other of the BDCs that are there. They do have a very high interest coverage. So this portfolio interest coverage is sort of a look-through basis, which is what you really want to get. Unfortunately, only themselves and Goldman Sachs really provide this information on a publicly traded basis, or disclose this information, which in my estimation is one of the key parameters you really need to understand these kind of businesses. They have no non-accruals, and again, sort of the customer concentration stuff that's there. If you look at above in terms of the valuations at this point, it's yielding roughly around 9.5%. You know, and so it's got some decent prospects. So the current valuation is roughly 8.9 times earnings, around 11.2% earnings yield. Again, if we use sort of the Graham formula, we're saying we're reasonably close. So I mean, you're talking about a 10% sort of expected return here, maybe a little bit lower teens as we're going forward. However, there's a very interesting catalyst that can happen here. Recently, the government has allowed BDCs to increase their leverage. And in this case, I feel very comfortable with these guys doing it because their underwriting process is so good. And therefore, they have gone through and they've received credit agency approval for increases with no change to their investment grade credit rating, which I think makes sense given sort of their underwriting process. And so in essence, this provides another little bump up. So your expected returns may go up from the low teens, you know, maybe 11% to 12 to 13%. So still given the ability to buy a set of cash flows that isn't uncorrelated, that's very uncorrelated with the market where you're getting most of your yield back right away, I think this is a pretty good opportunity today, given today's sort of opportunity sets in both fixed income and equity. And so the final one we're going to be taking a look at here is a company called Ashtead. Now, Ashtead is a lessor, so that's part of the lessor group of companies that we had originally identified as one of sort of these companies that have bond-like cash flows. And so basically, Ashtead is the number two lessor in the United States. United Rentals is the number one. Ashtead also has some operations in Canada and the UK. Right now, they've got roughly around 715 locations. Their business plan is a very interesting company in the fact that they have a very large runway in the business itself. And what they're focused at right now is they've got, you know, their growth, their basically core business probably has a 7 to 10% growth rate. And then through additional capital allocation of M&A and share buybacks, they can generate an additional 8 to 10%. So you're talking about a 15 to 20% earnings per share growth, where the company's probably trading at 7 to 8 times PE. It's really an interesting situation in the fact that, and part of, I think what the market's really saying at that kind of valuation is that there is some cyclicality to this business, but I think the company has put in some, has basically changed over time. And so I'm not saying the company isn't going to be cyclical, but in essence, what's going to happen is the cyclicality will be dampened as a result of the actions that the company is taking. The key piece behind the thesis here is as a large fragmented market in North America, there's a $63 billion addressable market of rental equipment. Ashtead is the number two player. They have roughly 8% of the market. The top three players have 23% of the market. So in essence, you've got a very fragmented market where these guys can continue to take the processes they've developed in these clusters. So what their focus in terms of a business strategy is, they're focusing on expanding their core business in clusters. This is a very, what I would call sort of a geographically domain business, probably similar to like radio and TV type businesses, where what really matters is not nationwide market share, but market share within the local municipalities, because that's what you're renting the equipment for. And so there's two ways they're going to grow. They're going to continue to grow in their clusters, but then they're also going to add new equipment, non-construction type of equipment, that they continue to lease out. And so they're able to leverage off this existing infrastructure to basically continue to, provide leased equipment to various construction and non-construction type people over time. So one of the benchmark, using our benchmarking approach here, right now, over the past 5 years, they've grown dividend and book value is at roughly 52% per year. And the return on equity is 33%. So in essence, this business has just done a really good job of, this guy's done a really good job of basically just, got some really nice growth factors there. Now, some caveats there. The growth is probably going to continue, but not at that level, given sort of the tailwind we've had of them starting to build up these clusters. But then in addition to also, just the market being favorable over the past few years. So what is the equipment leasing industry all about? Basically, they provide equipment to construction and non-construction markets. For a lot of customers, it's more cost effective to lease the equipment than to buy it. The way to look at this market, just sort of like radio and TV, it's more of a local market versus a national market. So it's a summation of these local markets. It's a large market where rental has 55% penetration. On average, the overall market's growing at a mature level. So most of the growth here is coming from basically expanding out in existing markets versus actually the market itself growing. And again, sort of it's a very fragmented market, so you're really dealing with a consolidation play here. So in this case, clustering is a key strategy. And you really only have two big guys in the US, and the economies of scale are just incredible in terms of what happens in this business. So the way that the company looks at sort of market entry is there's various clusters. And so when you enter a particular market, your primary customers are construction people. But as time goes on, your customers, basically non-construction customers basically begin to dominate as time goes on and you're in more mature clusters. Now, the way the company defines mature clusters is based upon the number of units and how long they've been in each market. And they've got some pretty good metrics on being able to take a look at that and being able to actually, quantify that. So they've done a pretty good job of thinking about this model and the way that they've sort of implementing it over time. So the largest firms in the market have huge synergies in the fact of sort of equipment selection. If you're the largest firm in the market, you can have a larger equipment selection of equipment, because in essence you can spread that over a larger group of people, and you're going to have cost advantage. You're going to have higher margins. So what these guys in essence are doing is they're developing moats on a local and regional basis. And what's really helped them a lot has been technology. Technology has basically facilitated and allowed these moats to basically be developed for these businesses. And so to give you an idea here, sort of this is the management team strategy on this. So they basically, again, equipment leasing is a local market. They've come up with this 2021 plan, and they've done a pretty good job since rolling that out. They've generated roughly 18% ROIs, which is above the WACC. They've increased their margins by roughly 9% above the last cycle. Again, that's sort of reflective of sort of these clusters and what they've been able to do along those lines. What they did enter the U.S. market by buying the second biggest U.S. company called Sunbelt Rentals. And so that's primarily the U.S. one they've got. The EPS has really grown relatively well. And the return on investments, should increase as the clusters mature. When they start out, they initially generate ROIs. Their ROIs are probably like in the high teens, but as they mature, their ROIs get closer to 29%. In terms of other sort of incentives, the company has done a really good job of setting up incentives. So they've got the management team is moderately compensated. They basically the options, they do a really good job of not issuing many options. The options dilution here is about 0.2% per year, and about 0.4% of the company is owned by management. But one of the things that they have done recently is they've basically had this living wage increase for people that are the low end, because these guys are sort of They're more of a equipment provider, and so they have provided some low end wage increases above what the normal inflation is to sort of to in realizing people providing a living wage for these types of folks also. So in essence, that's sort of the management team strategy and sort of their background. And so in essence, one of the key aspects here is sort of the clustering strategies we mentioned before. It provides for local economies of scale, efficient sharing of equipment. Technology can facilitate this. And again, they've successfully introduced non-construction type equipments in some of these clusters. Climate control and flooring systems are examples. And again, the thing about this thing is that although leasing is cyclical and tied to cyclical businesses, geographic reach can basically provide diversification, because in each region of the country, the economics of it's a little bit different. So the wider sort of geographic spread you have, the more diversified you're going to be. So again, we can go back to our total return sort of framework we've looked at here. We've got yield plus growth. The current yield's roughly around 2%. They've got a 15% payout ratio. So if we look there, and we're talking about a total growth of 15 to 20%, which is sort of like what they have and what they're planning on going forward. They have organic growth of 7 to 10 and then capital allocation and share buybacks. So recently, they did make a 10% share buyback in their fiscal year 2017. And this year, they're in the process of doing another very large share buyback, and they're buying shares back at roughly around 6% per year rate this year. Last year, they didn't do that because I think they were able to find some other ways to deploy their capital, but that's sort of what they're doing right now. Their five-year ROI is roughly around 18% versus the largest competitor, which is United Rentals. Their ROI is lower at 11%, and that's tax-adjusted. If you do it before tax adjustment, it's lower than that. But in essence, the tax adjustments do account for sort of the new tax law. Some of the other aspects of Ashtead is if you take a look at leverage, it's basically conservatively financed. It's 1.9 times EBITDA versus almost 3 times for United Rentals. It's an investment grade credit and has modest levels of debt, which is about 50.5% of equity. So if we look again at some of the numbers of valuation and benchmarking here, you can see what's interesting is Ashtead has a much higher ROI than United Rentals does, despite the fact that Ashtead is the number two in the market in the U.S. The U.S. has a much higher ROI and performance characteristics than the U.K. So Ashtead does have a U.K. business, but the numbers are significantly lower for those particular ones. And so, the one thing you'll notice is the overall margins are roughly the same between Ashtead and United Rentals, but the ROE is much higher for United Rentals, and a lot of that has to do with the leverage. So the leverage of Ashtead, so you've got a company here that basically is in a cyclical business. It's got a modest amount of leverage, but it's actually able to still make a good ROE because it has a higher ROI, and those are the kind of businesses I think that are nice businesses to have. One thing you could take a look at is in the last downturn, 2008, 2009, which was in their fiscal years probably closer to 9 or 10, their ROI went down to like 5%. But that was when the margins were lower and they didn't have quite the synergies they have now. And also the geographic expansion is much bigger in the U.S. And so the three components here, we have Ashtead, I talked a lot about United Rentals. Herc is a recent spinoff of Hertz. And so they're really the three. So these are the three largest players of equipment rental companies in the U.S. So again, we current valuation is roughly 7 times earnings, 14% earnings yield. Again, if you put in the growth numbers into the Graham formula, you get some really interesting upside potentials here. It's got a 2% dividend yield. The business is cyclical, but I really think a lot of this has been dampened versus the last cycle due to the consolidation and the increase in the EBITDA margins. Again, the increased geographic and non-construction diversification has added a lot to it. And again, these guys have generated the highest return on investment with some of the lowest leverage that's out there. During the great financial crisis, again, Ashtead's ROI went down to 5%. I think URI's and Herc wasn't available, actually was negative. But I think given sort of this new situation, it's a real interesting time in this business just because of the consolidation that's happened and also the you know, with that growth, I think has created some more stabilities for these types of businesses. So that's it. I mean, at this point, if there's any specific questions in regards to trying to what I try to show here is just some examples of sort of a framework that I've sort of been thinking about lately, and that really has to do with trying to come up with some ways to come up with some alternative ideas where the value is really going to be based a lot on current cash flow or cash flows that these businesses are generating. And they may not be as correlated with some of the other parts of the market, which are really tied more towards growth. I mean, this last one does have some growth aspects to it, but as you can tell by the earnings multiple, it's being valued as a cyclical, but I think it's becoming less cyclical over time, which I think is part of the opportunity here.
Well, Keith, thank you very much for the presentation. In the interest of time, I'm going to maybe ask a couple of general questions and then encourage our members to follow up with you directly with any specific questions on these three ideas. You talked about, obviously, the bond-like characteristics of these equities. How do you think about the inflation component in this context and the advantages that these equities may offer with regard to inflation as opposed to actual bonds?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, John. In each of them, so let's go through each of them one at a time. You actually have a store. Now, store is really going to be driven by their leases. Their leases have, majority of them have a CPI component associated with it. So that would just pass through in terms of increasing the lease escalators would basically be influenced by CPI in store. And so that should just carry through. And, you know, I mean, they may have high interest rates, but in essence, the spread should be retained. The same thing with TPG. TPG has all of their loans are floating rate, like 98% are floating rate loans, all based on LIBOR. So in essence, as inflation goes up, in theory, the short-term interest rates would go up, and the same thing would happen with them. It would just be passed through. The other aspect of TPG, which is nice, is the business, and the same thing with store, is the businesses that are their customers are the ones that are that have high returns on equity at this point. They're good-moded businesses, and good-moded businesses have a tendency to continue to do well even when inflation is higher. And in terms of Ashtead, I think, you know, that one, again, they should be able to, from an inflation perspective, increase the lease rates that they charge out their equipment for, especially given sort of the consolidating market. And with the consolidating market, your competition is going down. I mean, the nice thing about Ashtead is that, you know, in addition to, you know, there's just a lot of nice things about it. In addition to being able to pass along sort of these increases, you actually continue to get better margins as the business gets bigger and bigger. It becomes a, you know, you sort of get almost like a networking effect in terms of, you know, the moat just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's very tough. I don't think you can find a company out there with this type of a multiple that has that type of characteristic.
In terms of a capital allocation, when it comes to these kinds of opportunities, is there a way to generalize on what is typically the optimal thing for management to prioritize?
I think the key thing, let's go after the first two credit ones. What's key for both companies like Store and BDCs is underwriting. In my mind, that's the key, because if you got to make sure you don't lose money, because in essence, if you focus a lot on growth, which I think a lot of the BDCs have, you stretch and you compromise on underwriting to get growth. And in terms of those businesses, in terms of capital allocation, you want your capital allocator to have a very strict underwriting process, have a wide base of things to draw from, and then it almost becomes like an insurance kind of situation where, in essence, then the question becomes just, if you have a good underwriting process, the question becomes just trying to get a bigger and bigger group of people or opportunities to filter through your underwriting process that generates the returns. And so that's the way I look at both the TPG and stores, almost like insurance businesses, where in, like a Geico or one of these other kind of insurance businesses, where you've got, if you've got a good underwriting process, then your focus is on maximizing the spread that you can apply those processes to generate the returns. And both those, I think, are doing that. I think the mistakes in some of these businesses is where you have a flawed underwriting process and you apply the same sort of approach to a flawed underwriting process, and then you get underperforming returns, which I think is what's happening at the typical BDCs. And so in terms of, I think that those are for the, for both those types of companies. In terms of Ashteed, again, I think it's the underwriting may not be as important in that business, because in essence, you have the asset. If they don't pay, you take it away. So in essence, it's you have a little bit better like leverage over the collateral, and most of your customers are using these as key aspects of their business. And so they have a huge incentive to basically pay you first before anyone else, which is one of the key things about, you know, store and the real estate that they look at, is they try to look for companies where the property is mission critical. And I've talked with people in the business where, in essence, some of these businesses will pay their rent before they pay anything else, because that's so key to, and those are the kind of situations you want to try and find and finance and underwrite. And so I think that's key in each one of these cases, is being able to try to find those situations where you got a first claim on the asset and you're in a large growing market, which I think all three of these companies are, and that's where the opportunity, I think, is. Now, the pricing of the first two may be more towards fixed income pricing, but I still think you can get a decent rate of return. Even that coupled with the underwriting process, I think creates a pretty interesting opportunity.
And can you just elaborate a little bit more on the defensibility that you see with these businesses versus some others that may be kind of trading at bond-like pricing, but may not actually be that defensible?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key thing for like Ashteed clearly is their moats that they're building in this geographic clustering. I mean, clearly it becomes, the big guys are going to have advantage. You can just see by the margins, how the margins have gone up and the ROIs of the business have gone up. You know, at a similar, before the recession, this happened at both URI and in Ashteed, their margins have gone up by about 10%. So if you can get a 10% increase in margin, this is from the last peak to the current peak for both of these businesses. In essence, what you're seeing is it's building a defensible moat. I mean, and there's only two companies that are this big. There's no one else. I mean, that's the interesting thing about this leasing business. I've looked at it, and United Rentals has bought up pretty much a lot of people. So if you look at the top guys, you've got Ashteed at 8%, United Rentals at 12%, you've got Herc at maybe like 3 or 4, and then everyone else below them is like 1%. And so in essence, it's, you know, at that point, you just have this huge advantage that, and then you just keep on. The nice thing about these is that's in the Ashteed case. I mean, that's the defensible advantage there, is that you do have somewhat of this networking effect working for you in Ashteed. So that's where the defensible stuff. The defensible stuff in both TPG and Store comes from their process. Store, you can clearly see if you go on their website, they've thought about this thing, they've developed they have tons of experience in it. The same thing with TPG, and it's that process that really provides the advantage. And they're much more akin to, I would say, to other financial services type businesses. You know, you can look at why did Buffett like Norwest slash Wells Fargo? Again, it's the process, and it's basically, you know, and why are those guys better than the other? A lot of it is just the process. I think you can clearly see it in the results, especially of TPG versus the other BDCs. You just see it. It's just there. And you say, well, why don't other people go ahead and try and do it? I mean, I think part of the problem with the BDC thing is that if you've got all these bad loans to switch, it's going to take a long time. And the incentives are not there for the managers to do it. A lot of these are externally managed, so there's a huge amount of fees no matter what you do. So there's no incentive to make these things better in a lot of cases, because you still make the fees no matter what you do. And so that would be like in the case of the TPG and the BDCs. In terms of store, I think it's just their long-term approach to doing this. There's another one that I had mentioned, Broadstone. They're the same thing. They've been in this business for a long period of time. They've been in the real estate business. They used to run, they were real estate operators before they ran Broadstone Net Lease. And again, it's just having the experience and having the, you know, the connections, and then, you know, and basically just sticking to that. And the key thing in both ones, again, is sort of the underwriting process and the discipline, that both those companies, both TPG and STORE, could grow faster if they wanted to. But in essence, they're sticking to their underwriting discipline. And Broadstone did the same thing. There was a period of time where they were growing like crazy. They're a private company, so they have to raise capital, equity capital. And there was a period of time where they were doing really well and people were continuing wanting to give them equity capital. And they actually put a brake on the equity capital. Over this past year, they've basically gated the capital coming in, because in essence, they've said, okay, you know, we can't find enough properties to meet our underwriting criteria that can still get the rate of return that our investors are expecting to get. And so those types of companies that show that discipline, not only talk about it, but actually show it in their actions. I mean, what they've actually done when they've done that is they've turned away fee to basically say to retain, you know, to give the existing investors more return, which is what you want to see in these kind of situations, is what you want to see in a good underwriter. You want them to turn away fee. You want them to turn away work, basically walk away when things get crazy, and then basically stick with a very disciplined process. And so both those two ones I know in particular, STORE and Broadstone, really have done that. And in my mind, those are the kind of financial companies that you want to own. And over time, those guys have been rewarded.
And Keith, maybe just a last question, more broadly on your portfolio in general and your investment philosophy. The question on concentration, you've joined us a few times now, and you have these great ideas with a theme around them that's quite differentiated and unique. How do you think about how to size each of these ideas?
Well, it really depends upon, I guess, the specific situation. Like, for example, the fund that I run, we have roughly around 20 positions. So we have a diversified set of sort of these kind of themes across a number of different situations. But if you feel comfortable with these kind of businesses, you can concentrate. It really depends upon the individual. And so, I mean, I think for these three ideas, if people are interested, I would just have them, you know, reach out and dig into these companies and just sort of see what do they really think about them. I mean, one thing I'd like to get some feedback from folks is, if there's something you see on here that you think is completely wrong, tell me I'm totally wet and I'm out of the, you know, you disagree with me on something, and that's how the process gets better. But I think these are three interesting opportunities given sort of the current situation we've got, and it would appeal to primarily more of sort of the value oriented investor, which is sort of like where my bailiwick is. I'm not necessarily a growth investor, but I mean, you get, if growth comes with the value, like it is an Ashteed, which is an exception, it's a, you know, I'm not going to turn it away if it's there.
Terrific. Well, Keith, thank you so much once again for taking the time to be with us and share these ideas and your insights with our members. We truly appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, John.
Goodbye for now.